Good evening and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on February 20th, 2014. I'm your host, David Katzmeier, coming to you tonight with a special guest, Joshua Levitt, who is senior correspondent for the Allgemeiner, an international Jewish paper based in New York City. He reports from across the Middle East and can be found on Twitter at Joshua5737. We're going to talk a little bit about the changes that he sees in our daily lives. And we're going to get a comparison from what he has seen in the daily life cycles of America as contrasted to where he has been stationed around the world, such as in Spain and in the Middle East, where he has done reporting and gives us a different perspective. Previously, Joshua was a foreign correspondent for the Financial Times, based in Madrid, Spain, where he lived for 6 years. On sabbatical, he was a Knight Bagaho Fellow in Columbia University, the youngest ever in the program. In the private sector, he worked for hedge funds, energy companies, lobbies, and small businesses on communication issues. He will share his observations on social and economic trends that he witnessed as a journalist whose job it was to report on to his informed readers. His works on the Jewish newspaper and his years in the Middle East lend experience and insights he will share on a theater drama on World War II, which was in recent production in New York City, titled When Yellow Were the Stars on Earth. We're going to begin from a perspective of what this play was telling us about World War II life and make some observations on how we have changed since the middle of the 20th century into now. And then we're going to put this into a deeper perspective as we look at not only where we are and where we just came from in world history and what that means in our everyday lives, but we're going to try to see where we are in the world trends of large, slower moving cycles. And if, in fact, some of these things and trends that we're in right now have been forecast by seers of long ago, such as the ancient Maya and more. So I'd like you to welcome our guest to the show tonight, Joshua Levitt, who's here with us to talk about these things. Joshua, are you there?
I am, David. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Joshua, thank you for joining us. I had the pleasure of meeting you when we both attended a recent performance of When Yellow Were the Stars on Earth that was written and directed by playwright Franco Moschetti in the Cabrini Repertory Theater in New York City. You can find out about this at yellowstars.org, by the way. And what I was taken by as we had the opportunity to speak with some of the actors following that performance, your insights into the lives of people then and the archetypical aspects that were involved, these what were timeless but time were timely, but they're timeless aspects of our lives. You gave such insights on that. When I found out that you were a journalist and how much experience you've had, I asked you to be on the program to share some of your observations with our listeners so we can understand the cycles of change in action, not just in theory. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about this play, about World War II. What does it tell us about our lives? And then I want to go on from there, Joshua, and ask you a little bit about your work abroad. So, Joshua, but before we get into all that, would you just tell us a little bit about yourself, Joshua? Give us a little overview of some of the things that you've done.
Well, I just want to say that I'm excited to be on the show. I also really enjoyed meeting you. When you started that play, it was something that had been alerted to me by one of the donors to our newspaper, a lady who was actually on radio her whole career named Dr. Judy. And she has been a big supporter of the Allgemeiner, which is a kind of an old Yiddish newspaper that was taken over by this new generation. And they brought it online. And I guess the thing that I thought was really intriguing to me when I first met them, the young editor, was that the paper had been created to make an international viewpoint. And when you looked at all the local Jewish newspapers, you know, we were growing up, we would always get the in Boston, where I'm from, we would always get the Boston Jewish Advocate, and it would have these kind of small issues, and I always really enjoyed reading it, and I thought there was a lively debate. I never thought of working for it, really, until much later, and I was excited to meet this young guy, and what he, when this paper was created, it was designed really to be like a one international, you know, like the International Herald Tribune of Jews, you could say. And the guy who created it was actually worked for the Herald Tribune in the 60s. And when he passed on, this young man who was a student of his sons took over. Anyway, so I had a couple opportunities to do some interesting cultural work through the paper. And one of them was with Dr. Judy. And she's also pretty amazing, talking about a story. I guess we can talk about her later. But she, through this really kind of great fundraiser, really the week before the play, it was at the Friars Club in New York City, which is a really famous, something so famous I'd never even heard of it, but it's really famous because you see sometimes on television they have the Friars Club roasts. And it's kind of like the private gentleman's club of the world famous comedians. And after her career in radio, she was really like the, kind of describe her as like the Fraser Crane of radio. She was really the first kind of pop culture psychological doctor on the radio. And anyway, so she threw this great event with new Israeli ambassador to Washington. And afterwards, you know, she was talking about how one of her friends was in this play and what would I think about going? And of course I said I would go. And what so amazed me about the play, and I wrote a nice kind of review about it, and you can see this on Algemeiner, which is a little bit hard to spell. It's Algemeiner.com. And I've also made it so that you could get to my Twitter handle from there. So if you type in Joshua5737.com, that'll take you right to the Algemeiner too. And you can type in Yellow Stars, which is part of the name of the play. What I really liked about it, and what I was really surprised about it, is that I, you know, working in this newspaper and just in general, you'd seen a lot of Holocaust plays and movies and television shows, and a lot of them are from a Jewish perspective where the focus is on the, you know, either people trapped in the ghetto or people trying to escape concentration camps or people trying to hide from the Nazis, or, you know, the more exciting ones are the people who are in the resistance movements. Mm-hmm. And what made this play kind of interesting was that that was at the core, it was about Jews and resistance movement. But what I thought was so unique about it was that Franco Moschetti was the director and that he also wrote the script. What he did was also weave in the equally true and equally valid story of Germans who were caught in the middle and what I had never really seen, a very human portrayal of the Nazis. And I think what we forget about is the Nazis were a machine, but in the end, like, he really was able to portray there was a power struggle within the Nazis who were involved in this performance. And the play takes place towards the end of the war, and the Nazis know that they're beginning to lose. And you can see the sort of heightened drama that this Nazi captain and his lieutenant are facing. They themselves have a war between each other. And I really was just really impressed that he was able to bring that story and the Jewish resistance fighter stories. And then the plot sort of rounds out with the girlfriend of the Nazi who lives upstairs from where the Jewish resistance fighters are hiding in downtown Berlin.
Unbeknownst to them.
It kind of ties it all together, right?
Yeah.
And she's of course a cabaret singer. So maybe that's the only cliche thing about it. And I just thought the performances were great. I thought that he did an excellent job painting three different worlds. And then, and this was, as you mentioned, this was the second sort of edition of the play. They also added another thing that I thought was really well done, which was monologues in the beginning from people who represented the two daughters, the daughter of the female resistance leader and the daughter of the cabaret singer. And they kind of framed the play as if they were like on a Holocaust memorial lecture circuit or something, and they were telling the story for the first time to the audience. And the actress in particular who played the daughter of the German heroine in the film, she's actually a very famous actress, and she did such a stupendous job. From the very second she started speaking, I was transported to her story, which was growing up sort of like in a boarding school in the woods. She kind of missed all the action, but you were, you know, you really, I guess I would say that As a writer in drama, it's the words that your characters are saying, and it's the stories that you enliven with them with. And I think this play did an excellent job. So for me, it was a joy to attend it. And then, as you said, we got to meet each other and we got to talk to the other cast members. I also got to interview, because it's New York City, you never really know who else is going to be in the audience. And there was also a fabulous author there. I think she might be listening, Elizabeth Bettina. And she's written sort of a parallel story about rather than the Germans helping Jews in the world, she wrote about the Italians, who were the righteous Gentiles who helped Jews in Italy. So I thought it was great to get her feedback, too.
Absolutely. We're going to get to the phones here in a minute. We do have one caller on the line. Folks, if anybody wants to call in, you can call in at area code 347-884-9593. That's 347-884-9593. Very quickly, you mentioned one of the authors that was in the audience was Elizabeth Bettina, and she wrote her book, My Journey Through the History and Stories of Untold, it happened in Italy, Untold Stories. It was fantastic listening to her. In fact, she gave a testimonial of what that play meant to her, which we captured on video. A few people gave some video comments that are up online now at yellowstars.org. Because it's a perspective came through this play on the daily lives of people. It's a perspective that you don't get in many of the magnificent films that have been made and the stories that have been told and the plays that have been done, which have been so many of this time. Yet, Franco Moschetti and the crew and the development of this play gives a unique perspective in how it affected the lives every day through this horror. And in what we see there, we see things at ourselves that we recognize, but it also reveals things about ourselves that are somewhat surprising. And the surprising elements come through the remarkable bits of heroism that can come from somebody, the diamonds that are emerging from the pressure. Out of the coal of our existence come these diamonds when put under pressure, and it's a remarkable thing. But I want to go to the phones here for a minute, Joshua.
Please.
And
please.
We have a caller from area code 203. Hello, are you there?
It's Rhea.
Rhea, I recognize.
Hi, David. Hi, Joshua.
Hello.
Rhea
is one of the actresses in the play.
One of the actresses in the play. She played Anne and gave a magnificent performance.
Right. She's also the mom of the beautiful heroine in the play as well.
Yes, she is. And she told the story from present time, and then we went back in the time in the play. Rhea, how are you? Thank you for calling in.
I wouldn't miss this. I'm just so happy that it's happening. It was wonderful to meet Joshua at the show because his astute observations and memory of all the details that really were there on the physical and the subtle level were just so powerful because he really picked up on all the innuendos and the interwoven themes that are all so powerful. I was listening to another interview that you had with Franco, and what Franco said, and is supported by Joshua, is that the cast was so interconnected and loved the story and felt the strength of it and how it not only affected the actors but the people that viewed the story in the audience, because there is a numbness in the generations between the Holocaust and those living now. There's so many people who just know the word but feel nothing about it. They try to avoid it. What I believe the play does is open up a very deep level of feeling that we all have inside that we try not to go to and hope goes away. the play allows us to tap into those feelings and transform them into love, because the underlying theme of the story is a universal love that goes beyond any nationality and anything in the past or present. It just bonds us through a very powerful feeling of love.
It does for you. And indeed, it would be an irony if this terrible, terrible experience left us numb from those who lived through it and from those of us who live in its echo, because sometimes you mention the feeling, you sometimes have to feel the feeling. And even if it means invoking unpleasant feelings, even if it means bringing in something that's now in the morphogenic field, which is this terrible shock, we have to let this go through us. Sometimes the only way out of difficulty is through it. It's a samskara. And you've actually got to go through the ring of fire, feel the feeling in order to get past it. Why? Because of all ironies, the brutality and the cruelty that often results in any time or culture is when you have a repression, when you have a society or even an individual, fractal relationship here, where a person suppresses their own soft side, their feminine side, be they man, be they woman, then that person or that nation has a tendency to cruelty. And in this machine era of the 20th century, in the 19th century, where everything was physical, not so much emotional, not so much intellectual, then what you had was a powder keg of repression that could only express itself physically, and that came in the form of violence. At that time, men had two emotions, anger and whiskey. That was it. And so so now that we have gone through this, we've got to learn that we have to feel the feeling in order to transcend to love, as you said, which is one of the beautiful things there, because that's what is more powerful than any of this and all of it. Joshua, any view on that from your end?
Well, listen, I think what you just said was very powerful, and I think what Rhea said also about the losing the power of the word. And there's one scene in the play that really struck me, and this is actually Franco in the evening that I saw. He had to step in as an understudy for he plays the character Wolfgang, who is the brother of the cabaret singer. And he just is basically the German army doesn't want anyone who's been at the front to come home. And he gets injured and he kind of gets his way home. And he's heartbroken because he has to tell his sister the story of the massacre. You know, his sister is trying to confirm with the Nazis, her boyfriend, is it true, the rumors I heard in the market that Jews are being eliminated? And he confirms it to her and he you know, describes, I think it's the most chilling scene, or one of the two, I guess, chilling scenes that come out of the Holocaust for me. He describes this one where Jews in a village outside of Russia on the border are being told to take shovels and dig a huge trench and then line up along the border of the trench, and then the Nazi soldiers are going to shoot them. And in the play, what happens is that this guy Wolfgang is in the army with his best, you know, friend from the neighborhood. And his friend refuses the order. He just is incapable of shooting, you know, obviously a child in the head after digging a trench for his grave. And their superior, the Nazi superior, comes behind him and shoots him in the head. So you're like, it's like violence to violence to violence. You know, yeah. And the other image that for me really speaks to it, and this was an interview we did a few months ago with a pretty amazing gentleman who was a British major who was on the sort of first wave that was liberating the camps of Bergen-Belsen. And as part of his crew, when he went in there, they had video cameras. And when I'm watching the footage, what I saw that was, you know, almost so horrifying was that there was however many thousands of people alive still in the camps, there were an equal number of dead bodies. And there was a tractor, like a caterpillar tractor, that was just picking up dead bodies and pushing them into a ditch. And so to me, like, when you talk about the losing the value of the word Holocaust, and people use it a lot, it really pains me when I see people saying trying to like bring it into modern day politics. I'm just sort of like, show me some place where people have so many dead bodies lying about that you need a caterpillar tractor to start moving them, or show me where there's a ditch where armies are lining up thousands of people in a village. And I can tell you that my family is from a village, similar kind of vision, where 30,000 people were murdered in, 1942. So it happened. It happened. It sure did happen. And so if we lose the value of those things, then we, we forget the history. History just becomes a word or a chapter in a book, and that becomes a word and then a tagline and then a Twitter handle, and then there's nothing left.
Well, you put something very important there.
Yeah, that's the reality. But I just want to make a comment. I think also what you said, I had never really thought about it. I just jotted this down. People repressing the feminine side of a society, and is it the only outburst is tendency to cruelty. I mean, that's very fascinating. I never really thought about it. I can think of my own personal life that in the times when I've had like an artistic striving to do something and I haven't done it, there's this anger and disappointment in yourself for not having allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I can only think if there was an entire society of frustrated young writers and they were all armed, it'd probably be a dangerous place.
Yeah, I'm sorry to chuckle, but your point is
problem,
taken. And lest we forget, because energy will find a way. You don't destroy anything. You only change its form. And so, if you have a repression of one way, then you have to have a displacement somewhere else. And this is, lest we forget, we have to have an understanding of time. We have to remember what had happened. There's even people that have tried to say today that this whole Holocaust did not even occur. It's very important for us to learn the lessons in history. And there, according to the theory of chaorhythms, the cycles of change, we find that there are cycles in history. When we understand that there are tides in the affairs of man, then we can put things in a different perspective. You see, we have a tendency to see the way things are now as simply the way things are and the way they should be. And then we try to hold these models that we put up at the time for eternity because it is the right way. But in reality, if we understand that we're sometimes in a high tide and a low tide, there's a day and a night that takes years or centuries, we understand where we are. If we're farming, we know when to plant and we know when to harvest. But when we're living our lives in cycles that are not so common to understand as the yearly cycle of the sun, then we are going to not understand where we are. We're not going to know where we're coming from. We're not going to know where we are. And we certainly are not going to know where we're going. So we have to remember our history to do that. Rhea, what was the most moving aspect of being in this play that told of a dramatic time in our lives in the world?
Well, the most moving aspect for me is how it transformed me. Because I watched the show through every rehearsal and through every performance, and I saw it as one unit, not individual themes. What changed was the depth that I responded to it. I can go from the beginning to the end. I could point out levels of emotion that just blew me away. But the bottom line was that Wanda, who played the cabaret singer's daughter, and I did watch the show together each time, and we, through each performance, kept feeling it was more and more powerful, and that it was changing us, that we were releasing a lot of pent-up emotion and thoughts about the past. We started to confide in each other about certain things that had happened in our lives, and you don't usually just open up and share certain things that have happened. So it did have an effect of onion skins peeling away layer by layer, which allowed us to become closer to ourselves and each other and the group as a whole that was performing. And that was the experience of the entire cast. So we really bonded. And I know that happens in every performance. But the level of the bonding in this was just remarkable.
Absolutely. And I thank you for sharing how this changed you, because it helps us to realize something, that not only we have to understand how we change the times, we must also understand how the times change us. That's the lessons of history. That's why we've got to know that the wheels keep on turning. That's why the cycles of change is important for so many reasons. It's not just for playing the market. It's not just for buying clothes right before they come into fashion. It's for a self-realization on a mass scale. And we can't do that unless we understand where we are in the influx, the fluctuation, the undulations of time. So that, I thank you for that, Rhea Ross, who played the role of Anne. And When Yellow Were the Stars of On Earth, recently performed in New York City Theater, the Caprini Repertory Theater. You can find out more about this, see some video interviews with Rhea Ross and some of the cast members and people who saw this, and learn a little bit about its creator, Franco Moschetti, by going to yellowstars.org. That's yellowstars.org. And we're going to move on a little bit to another part of the world. Coming next into Spain. And Joshua, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your time there to get a different perspective. As a foreign correspondent, you were posted in Madrid. You gained an alternative view of time, rhythms, and cycles in the daily life there. After all, the famous Spanish siesta is at midday, dinner is at 10 p.m., and all of August and half of December, you have off for the holiday. This sets a different pace than what we have in America. But also, I want to ask you about one of the last events you covered in Spain. It was 10 years ago when millions of Spaniards gathered in the Plaza Colón to show solidarity with families who lost 200 people on March 11, 2004, with the Al-Qaeda train bombing. This is a Holocaust of a smaller scale, but try telling that to any of the individuals involved. They demanded in this mass demonstration that the government be toppled in a planned election that weekend. So chaos and disorder, oddly enough, are part cycle. They come when it is due. It was certainly due then in Spain. And Joshua, you were there to report on this. So can you tell us a little bit of this horror that you witnessed and reported on while you were in Spain?
Yeah, no, that's great. I think, I think for me, it was really, you're talking about before, you mentioned pivotal times when times change or when you see things moving in a different way. And it was really that day. I cannot believe it's 10 years now, 10 years and about 21 days from now. That really showed me how different things are and different things could be. I arrived in Spain actually as a student, had an internship at a news agency, Agence France-Presse, AFP, and they had a financial English language service called AFX News. That was something that was created by the Financial Times and AFP. And this was, in the early, I guess it was created in the 90s, I think. And if you can think back, some of the listeners, some of the younger people aren't going to realize this, but, that whole news agency business was set up because people didn't have internet. And the news agency had this special machine that would send information to a satellite, and that would send it to London, and London would send it to computers, and it would be sent to the stock market machines. I mean, all of this pre-internet stuff and pre-cell phone stuff. Mm-hmm. And, we used to, there was one cell phone for the office we would sign out when we'd go to press conferences and stuff. And I guess the tipping point, to use the Malcolm Gladwell phrase, is on March 11th, 2004, really what happened was there was just a couple of young guys. They were first-generation Spanish or first-generation immigrants. They were living really in the same neighborhood where I was living. That was right in the center of the city. And, talking about cycles, the neighborhood that these guys lived in was called Lavapiés, which means wash your feet. And it was if you go to the neighborhood now, you see a lot of the street signs are things right from New Testament things, Mary and Joseph, all these different names. And what I was really surprised to see that this neighborhood actually was the Jewish neighborhood in old Madrid. And when the Jews were kicked out of Spain in 1492, it became really, they quickly thought, what's the best thing we can do but change the signs of the roads? And that, you know, marked the time for them. And then I was really kind of, I thought it was ironic that it became a really strong immigrant neighborhood in modern-day Madrid just because it was, you know, it was a cheap thing close to the city. Anyway, what these guys did was, out of nothing, really, they were not fervent believers, really. They really just got swept up in something political, internationalist, global. We can talk more about that. And what they ended up doing was using a cell phone in a backpack with some dynamite. You know, it was funny, the dynamite they got, you know, these were, you know, obviously like not such fervent believers because they met a guy in a bar and they traded bricks of hashish to get all the dynamite they needed. And this guy was an out-of-work miner from the north of Spain. And they used the dynamite, they connected it to their cell phones, and at, you know, 8 in the morning it was, or quarter to 8 in the morning, they lit these things off. They lit them off in a, they used the commuter rails right as the rails were arriving at the station. You know, and then, the people who actually died, you know, maybe it's the most tragic thing, they were the working class people from the sort of less wealthy neighborhood outside the city who were coming in for their jobs at 7 in the morning. But what struck me about the whole thing was, the politicians' response, obviously. This was a conservative government, and they had done a lot of work on so I worked for the Financial Times. So for me, it was, you know, the entire time I was working there for 6 years in Spain, and the entire time for me really was a story of Spain trying to become economically fit to be part of the European Union. So the government in charge, like their whole business was, prime minister himself was a tax inspector, and their whole business was to get Spain on the books. So to try to get all the undocumented things documented again, to make it like a civilized European place. And, you know, in some levels they were successful. In other ways, they were deficient, like the same way California got overdeveloped and Florida got overdeveloped, so did Spain. And Spain was so overdeveloped that it crashed, and it's really demoralized the nation now for almost about 10 years as well. I mean, it's really 2005 and 6, so 8 or 9 years. Yeah. And but to bring it back to that day, the other thing that this government did was they were really hard on Basques. And the Basque, anyone remembers the sort of the quick story of Spain is that you have united by the Catholic kings. You know, this was the same 1492 again. They really used this idea of getting rid of the Moors, as the Muslims were called back then, getting rid of the Jews and making a war to eliminate their rivals and then use that as an excuse to band everyone else together. And they banded together all the different little mini principalities and fiefdoms around Spain. And what you ended up having even today is they talk about these autonomous communities. And most of them are on the same page, with Madrid being the sort of financial and political center. But there's two of them that really stick out, and that's the Basque country in the north and Catalonia, where Barcelona is in the northeast. And these are people who really claimed, you know, different lineages. I mean, the Catalans, if you look at it, they're a bridge between Spain and France and Italy in that top corner. And they had a different sort of culture than someone like Madrid, which was really like a mountainous desert. And then in the Basque country, you had people that really claimed to be of a different race, actually, altogether. And their language is totally non-Latin language. But I would say if you go there, you look around, you sort of feel like you're in Spain. You know, so if that's part of the sniff test. They were certainly different, but they felt more Spanish than they did Portuguese and more Spanish than they did French. So for that reason, maybe is why they stuck.
You hit on
one of the things one of the things the government did there was the government was really hard on the terrorists. And so what happened was in the Basque country, when people didn't feel that they had been brought in enough into the political spectrum, they resorted to terrorism. And it's kind of like the same thing that you had mentioned before, that when people don't feel that they're part of the right thing, their last resort is violence, and that's what these guys did. So when the terrorist bomb explodes in Madrid in 2004, you know, on a scale that the Basques had never contemplated. The Basques thing was really more of like attacking an army person at a barracks, or threatening, saying that a bomb had been put somewhere, and then alerting the police, who would, you know, deactivate it. But well, you know what? This was really carnage. This was, you know, I remember the front page story from the FT we wrote was standing outside the train station. The guy was on a phone, and he was telling someone what he saw. And I can remember the guy talking about it, and it was something like, you know, he saw limbs. He saw blood and saw limbs flying around. And so the Spanish people, who were basically known throughout the world as a very easygoing, let's enjoy life, let's enjoy the vino kind of atmosphere, which I have to tell you, I enjoyed every single day I was there. They were also confronted by, you know, not a one-person hit. They were confronted by hundreds of people dead, and then, you know, thousands, or I think maybe the number was 1,400 or something, that were injured in that explosion. And so the government said, you know, this must be the work of the Basques. We will vow to get them. And, you know, as the day went on, it became sort of more questionable that, wait, maybe something was happening here. Maybe, you know, maybe all of the work the government had done economically and in Europe, and then ultimately with the United States, because Spain, if you remember, raised its hand and said it would stand with the United States and it would stand with the UK,
yes,
and Poland and a couple other small countries to go in fight Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
And you know what? You know, within 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, pretty much everyone saw that actually what was happening here wasn't this Basque problem that was a Spanish problem that had been a 100-year-old problem. This was something that Spain, by sticking its neck out, was going to get slapped, and it did. And I think something that really happened there that kind of boggled my mind was that the next night there millions of people had gathered, and it was, I think, the first time in sort of political history that the cell phone had been put to such amazing use, because, you know, at the time the government still controlled the everything. You know, there's obviously some free press and the radios and things like that. But in Spain, way much more than the United States, like in the U.S. you have ABC and CBS and NBC and Fox. Mm-hmm. That was really it in Spain. So there wasn't this whole profusion of thousands of channels. It really was still dominated by the biggest channels, and two of the biggest ones were the state channel. And they weren't going to say a different story until the government really said to.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what happened was people started with a text message, the same way the Spanish had used its cell phone to throw, you know, invite 50 of their friends for a party. They were inviting 50 friends to this march. And I remember being in the office looking out and seeing this and just thinking, like, this is like a sea change in world history, because no more can people be obfuscated, no more can the government – you know, can the government convince you that it's right if the people disagree? And I think, you know, we saw that same thing play out in Iran, you know?
Yeah, the Iranian Revolution, which was almost successful until Ahmadinejad actually suppressed it. But that was a war brought to you by Twitter. And
on Egypt this past year. So, I mean, really, what happened was, and what did technology bring us? So technology, for a long time, from the government's point of view, technology and radio broadcasts and the newspapers, it allowed them a way to influence what people thought. And now technology, we're in the hands of the consumer, where there's an in and out switch. Everyone has their own walkie-talkie, and those walkie-talkies can be harnessed via your Twitters and your Facebooks. That really has changed how people have to behave. I think the governments have to be so much more responsive. I mean, you can see now, as a journalist again, you can see how many stories, well, we used to talk about, we used to call them a storm in a teacup, but these stories can start on Twitter when a government minister makes some kind of crude remark, and it can end, you know, hours later, like people are losing their jobs because of five or six words they put out online.
Yeah, with social media, but a tempest in a teapot is not isolated, because everybody's sharing the same tea on a broad scale, you know, through this branch work. And let's focus on this a little bit. The cell phone, the social media as a tool, why it works. Why is the pen mightier than the sword in today, which means that the cell phone is mightier than the sword. How much have we changed since World War II? I want to explore that just a little bit with you, Joshua. Back in the time of the 20th century, 19th century, as in many times, our wars were nationalistic. It was nation against nation, army against army. Soldiers had uniforms. Even in some 19th century battles, the armies of opposing sides would meet at predecided locations and times and do battle and all that order. Later, by the end of the 20th century, we got into the concept of total war. Not only were our armies going to beat your armies, we're just totally going to ravage your entire town. We're going to take out all of your railroads, your industry, your water plants, and we're going to bomb your civilians and everything like that. But now, you know, that was for the conquest of domination of one nation to become the supreme because, you know, every nation that had ambitions of war viewed themselves as the center of the world. And so everybody was going to be a satellite of them or a colony of them. So but what we're seeing now in the virtual wars of today, we're having battles that are flying underneath the radar. We're not having there's not so much nationalistic contention as idealistic difference. Because when you look at the attacks on Washington and in New York on September 11th, then it wasn't so much that we were attacked by a nation, as happened in 1941, but it was people from various nations united together on an ideology with a very angry point. And so what's happening is the cells that are planted around trying to usurp the protective measures in place are seeing themselves as united by an idea. And they're reacting, and this warfare is done, it's a virtual thing. It's across the fences. So why is that? Well, if you look at the theory of collaborations, I want to view this very quickly from one perspective. Sometimes you have times that were physical, times that were emotional, and times that were intellectual. What's happened in the 20th century was a physical time while the emotional, intellectual energies of the world were low. And that meant might makes right. What's happening now is that the physical cycle is low while the emotional, intellectual energies are rising, but crossing through a very critical period of action along the way. So what do we have? We have ideological differences usurping the old forms. As fences come down, the world is flat, and we have ideology over nationalism, not only in trade, but even in warfare. But through it all, as we're going into our new era, we're finding that the cell phone is mightier than the sword, because in the world of rock, smashes scissors, which cuts paper, which covers rock. The revolving spotlight of time means that every dog has its day, as the saying goes. So the powers are shifting. And as the powers shift, because the rhythms of time are shifting, that means the power centers where they are in the world and what they are in the world are changing. So look out for people uniting socially on the internet, which can be more powerful than tanks like the likes of which were stopped before the Kremlin at the end of the Soviet Union. So this is a little bit, this is how what you're saying resonates to me as we compare some of the events in Spain with what was happening in Germany just a couple of generations ago. The cycles have changed.
Now, one of the things I thought that was remarkable in Spain was that, I saw that technology had just done this amazing leap. You know, and the Spanish people had been, you know, they had suffered under dictatorship until 1975. There was really one radio station, and then they finally got television. There was one station. Like, they really were living so far away from the modern times in some ways. And suddenly, with this cell phone revolution, they were in modernity. And
it's time.
At the same time, I thought about 9/11 as well, and I thought that, to me, 9/11 was a tricky thing because I thought that the United States, and you can say Spain in this example of terrorism, the United States, though, had really had this, you know, the world's biggest army, and they had thought about all different ways that countries might attack them, and they never thought that someone would take a huge flying missile, also known as an airplane, and then they would take it and aim it at something so kind of easy to hit. which is like the tallest skyscraper in the city. And, you know, so to me, it really meant that they were kind of like the people who were the bad guys, in quotes, were really, they had figured out a way to subvert everything. So these guys were subverting defense, you know, to basically kill thousands of people from inside.
Yep.
The technology itself was subverting government-dominated communication by giving everyone the ability to communicate.
Yes.
When I thought about the United States response in terms of air travel, and the thing that, you know, the image that always impacts me is when I see an 85-year-old grandmother, and I travel with my 92-year-old grandmother, and when you see someone like that having to take their shoes off and, you know, be almost like path search down, you're just kind of thinking, like, this is supposed to be the land of freedom, and there's, why are we losing our freedoms? Or what is even the word to describe it? And I had these ideas, and I brought it up with a friend of mine. He might be listening out there, named Tony, and he was a real character, Mexican, Sicilian, and I knew him really well in Madrid. And he said, man, haven't you heard? I said, what do you mean, haven't I heard? This is 2004. Haven't you heard about the apocalypse and the Mayans and this is all happening? And I'm, you know, I really hadn't heard about any of that stuff. I was really covering economics and finance, so which was kind of like the world's problems can be solved if you figure out who makes more money in every transaction. And then it was politics, which was the money equation plus which band of gangsters was going to be able to take control. Because whether you like the left or the right, like ultimately it was 50,000 bureaucrats that basically got in or got out. And yeah. Then finally when you got to this final step, which is really the one that dominated my thinking really since then, was to understand things in historical perspective like we're talking about now, but also in this idea of religious perspective, which is what I'm working on. And at the time, this thing with Mayans was really like almost like this cosmic multi-year cycle, you know, because I think like someone, you know, if this whole thing was going on, I think I was 27 years old, and I had only seen what I'd seen, and although I was smart in so many different things, the sort of lack of knowledge and wisdom in so many other things really impacted what I perceived. And when this buddy of mine told me about the Mayan, I really just started looking it up, and right away I found that there was people were really picking up those same things, that wow, there was this idea that things were going to drastically change and you didn't even think about it, and that it was going to change the way you perceive about so many things. And when I read about the things that were going to change my perception, I really agreed. Like another one was money itself. Mm. And I thought that, I thought that writing about money, I would, that's like the one thing I could understand. And what someone said to me, said, well, listen, what if someone like bin Laden knew he was going to do the 9/11 attack, and then he used your stock market against you, because he knew that the world was going to go into chaos, and he shorted all the stocks of all the airplanes and all the anything else he wanted the day before.
He could have done that.
You know, and when you recognize that someone could do that, then you're saying, well, someone, you know, some guy who was going to basically take domestic aircraft and use it as a military aircraft, he might as well take our system of money making and use it as a system of basically funding his operations. Like, why not? And
that's intellectual over physical again, you know, using the commerce system and flying under the radar of defenses instead of marching in with tanks and rifles.
Of course, because the paradigm that we had was that we were going to have tanks like we did in World War One, which was fought all along one line, you know, or we were going to have, you know, I think the government figured out a little bit of it, but I don't think that was, I just think it's kind of like, you know, the David and Goliath kind of. It's much harder. Well, we can talk more about that, but I guess what I want to get to the point was more about the Mayan, because I know that's really what you're listening to.
Well, you mentioned the Maya, and there was a lot of attention on the Maya. It heated up and it cooled off for a little bit, but there are people who devote their lives to studying this. I went down to Honduras in the ancient city of Copan on a year ago, December, and in fact, I was there on December 21st. I had a wonderful tour of the pyramids and the ruins with world-famous archaeologist David Sadat, who has lectured at University of Pennsylvania, And he discovered mummies in some of the pyramids down there. And so he gave us an in-depth understanding. I also stumbled across the Mayan calendrics, not looking for it, but because of other things I was looking at led me to it. And the Mayan culture studied the cycles in every aspect of their lives. We say the Mayan calendar ended on December 21st, but of 2012. But that was only one of many calendars. That particular calendar is called the Long Count, one that lasts some 25,125 years plus some days. But they also had a yearly cycle. They had a 260-day cycle, which they called the Dzogchen, and they had a 360-day cycle, which they followed. So, it was a very fractal calendar. But the one that became very famous was the Long Count, which was a linear calendar that ended every 5,000 plus years. And so everybody said, well, what does that mean? So is that what intrigued you, was the Long Count?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I was interested in, really shortly after this happened in Spain, I was offered a chance to study in New York, and I came to the United States. And if you remember, this was 2004, was the election with George Bush and John Kerry. And what I had been absent from United States politics, really, and someone told me that people who believed in the apocalypse were supporting George Bush. And I'd never heard of such a thing. You know, I'd sort of missed this whole business happening here. And I got really interested in reading about it and learning about it. And I guess my takeaway, there was a great article in New York Times Magazine, and it said, you know, this is the reality-based candidate, John Kerry, against the faith-based, incoming president, George Bush. And I said, you know, that's fine. In the United States, there's so many people who are reality-based. But what about everyone else in the world, actually, whose reality is the faith-based reality? So what if, when you talk about crusades, people, like, that's what they think you're talking about. And it got to me thinking that, you know, if people are talking about apocalypse, Christian apocalypse, why is it that they're having that conversation at the very same time the Maya are also talking about the apocalypse? So I wanted to learn, to see what I could learn about the Maya. And I had, I was in New York. I was a fellow at Columbia, which really was a pretty amazing opportunity. And you're basically a paid student. You know, you're basically like so you're almost like a professor. You get paid, you have an apartment, and you just got to learn stuff. And I, you know, like an underemployed journalist, I got myself into lots of books. Mm-hmm. And I read about a conference that was happening in Arizona with a lot of the Mayan scholars, and I went. And I learned so many things about it, and I'll give you my brief take. You did a great summary of it. But what I understood was that they're talking about a 26,000-year calendar. So when we get really excited, we talk about, you know, that the year 2000 was this great momentous thing with three zeros.
Yeah.
These guys are talking about something 26,000. And then they broke that into five parts. And the last part was 5,200 years, which for, like, the Maya was only one-fifth of how they saw the world.
And they
for Western civilization, it is the entire Western civilization.
Yeah.
You know, that goes to 3,000 BC. So that pretty much goes as far back as we're talking about it. So what they're really saying was that was the age of man that we just did, and all these other things happened before, to put it in context. And that exactly as you said, it wasn't that the world ended. It was really that this cycle finished up, and this next cycle, which they didn't really talk about because it was so far away from them, was really starting.
So they're defining ages in our civilization.
Exactly the way we talk about the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, the cell phone age, the Google age, whatever you want. They were basically just sort of – they were doing something on a bigger time span. And I think maybe the biggest weakness that we have now – I think we are approaching the wisdom society, but what we don't have is or what we have but we don't do as much as we want to is to really try to put the right perspective on things again. It's really easy not to breathe and to constantly be checking your phone. But what you, like, kind of realize is that, like, the pace of it all has really impacted us in a different way. So if you were to slow down and say, like, there's people now who can't leave the house without their cell phone, And then I compare those to people I know who don't have a phone yet and people I know who don't have computers yet because, you know, they're old and they never got around to it.
Yeah.
Versus old people actually I know who have computers and versus people that have cell phones. And you realize, like, it's kind of like this. So one of the things the mind showed me was that you could slow down, you could do things from another way. And another thing that I learned about the Mayan calendar I thought was really fascinating, and this guy, I think you'll know, it's Jose Arguelles, I think the name was.
He wrote the Mayan Factor.
And, you know, this guy got up in front and he said, have you heard about the 13-month calendar? And I said, no, I hadn't learned about the 13-month calendar. And he said, well, look at it for a second and think about this. Why is it that the calendar we're using keeps bumping around all the time? Like, your birthday one year is on the Tuesday, and then it's on the Wednesday, and months have different numbers in them. Why don't you have a calendar that had 13 months, each of them of 28 days, so basically 4 weeks, fixed weeks, that start on the same day, and, you know, like, why don't we have this 28 times 13 calendar?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he gives a great story about why we don't have it, but basically, the short version is that 28 times 13, you're still missing one day.
Yep.
And that one day in the Mayan way of doing the math was what they would call the day out of time, which is kind of like the New Year's Day. That would just be a day off, and they would start over. But when they brought that calendar to sort of the Christian or the, you know, the papal people in charge, basically creating the calendar that we use now, they just said, no, that totally violates this whole idea.
And
you have a day.
Explain to our listeners a little bit about what you're talking about. Is the Mayans had a base 20 system, not a base 10 like we use. They called it a vigesimal system. That's what we call it. And they had 13-day weeks and 20-day months. And the main daily life calendar that they follow is a 260-day Dzogchen, which is the combination of these 13-day weeks and 20-day months. And because of the various cycles that they followed, they had a 360-day year and a 365-day year so that it would synchronize with the sun and the change of seasons. And so what would happen at the end of a 360-day cycle, while you still have 5 days left over, they added the 5 days, which they called a wayab, to the 360-day cycle that they were following to give them a 365 and reset the clock to synchronize. Synchronize your watches? Well, synchronize with the sun, which is what time of the year it is. And they were considered unlucky days during that time. But with what happened is they would resync everything like that and keep the clockwork going. So they kept their large calendrics running like a Swiss watch, if you will. So I just wanted to explain that for our listeners, Joshua.
Well, I think that's great. And I think, like, you know, I guess what I took away from it was that there are different ways, you know, different ways to count it. Is it six, half a dozen, or six, or what is it? And I think their system was, you know, it was a spiritual element in those different overlapping systems, the same way you might have a horoscope now. And I also used it, I started to look at the Jewish calendar as well in a different light, in that it was talked about that, like a lunar calendar. So I didn't know if you realize this, but the Jewish calendar, basically, the Hebrew calendar is based on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And my birthday falls on the 13th day of the Hebrew month of Heshvan. And the cool thing about that is that in the middle of the month, so day 14 out of the 28-day month, is always the full moon in this calendar.
Mm.
So my birthday was on a full moon when I was born, and it's on the Hebrew calendar. It's always the full moon, basically. So to me, that kind of signified that it was it was a different way to be in tune with the season. And the thing I thought that was neat also was that in the Gregorian calendar we use, we have to add the famous leap day every 4 years.
Yeah.
In the Jewish calendar, they have to add a leap month to make that correction. But, you know, it's kind of like when someone says which is more accurate, you know, the digital watch or the analog watch. Well, if they're both telling the same time. So I think they're all accurate. And I just thought it was, you know, time is something that's kind of extraordinary because it determines your place by you determining your time. So, for example, like when you talked in the earlier discussion, you talked about how people see things linear, in a linear way. Like, To me, like, if you really just look at everything in a straight line, then you really miss reflecting on the pattern that you created to get on that line.
That's right.
And so if, you know, by us focusing so much on this kind of, like, production idea, we really miss out on this on the reflection that you can have when you actually slow down for a second and take in the fact that there probably are patterns.
Exactly. And get away from the Western notion of everything is sequential and just a linear progression of cause and effect. And when you look into the cyclical periods followed by the ancient Maya from small to immense, and compare them to how the Chaldeans and Babylonians were able to chart out the precession of the equinoxes, also 26,000 years long. And you look back at in Sanskrit and see how they studied cycles, or what they called kalpas, and came up with yugas of hundreds and thousands of years, from which Hesiod derived the term of bronze, stone, silver, and gold eras. He got that as the eclectic ancient Greeks got many things from Sanskrit. So this leads to one question, you know, of the lessons that we can learn from the Mayan and from others. How could they come up with ages that are defined in so many years of immense period when no person lives through that period of time? They live through only a drop in the ocean of that period of time. How can they see a clock moving with hands so large? And I believe the answer to that may be is because they understood the cycles of time. And when you understand cycles and the fractal relationship of a person to a nation to the world community, and you understand that there are seasons and things great and small, that what is here is elsewhere, then you can put things into the perspective of the macrocosm and the microcosm. In the physical universe, we were understanding more in the 20th century that as we explored further with the telescope and more into the microscope, we were finding similar patterns in each, from subatomic matter to the motion of the galaxies. Maybe we're seeing a little bit of how the ancients were able to define eras in our society, which do exist, and even be able to tell us how long they were. Because when you see the small, you can understand the great. Because, as you said, Joshua, we need to understand the patterns. We're pretty much wrapping up here at the end of our program. And I want to thank Joshua Levitt, who has shared some of his views. He's a senior correspondent at the Allgemeiner newspaper. And I'm going to spell that for you, folks. Allgemeiner is Allgemeiner.com. To go to the website, as I advise you do. And we began talking about a very moving play, about a very moving time in history, called When Yellow Were the Stars on Earth. We had a guest call in from Rhea Ross, who was one of the actresses in that play. Rhea, thank you for joining us tonight. And I invite you folks to find out about this momentous story and the works of Franco Moschetti by going to yellowstars.org. So, Joshua, before we wrap up here, we covered some wonderful things, different times and different perspectives, and your insights are very clear and very rich. Are there is there any message you would like to leave our listeners as we talk about the cycles of change?
Yeah, I think first of all, thanks for having me on the show. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I'm thinking a lot about how you know, your message of fractals, what you do, has this amazing impact. The way a leaf on a tree is the same growth as the tree itself, is the same growth as the orchard itself. So I think the message that I learned through a lot of this study was to recognize that we all play a role because we are indeed the fractal. So I recommend your listeners to study up, read about that. And then try to find ways in their life that they can better represent it.
We are indeed a fractal. Fractals in civilization and fractals in time. Joshua Levitt, Ray Ross, I thank you for joining us tonight.
And I thank you all for listening to the Cycles of Change radio program. Join us here every Thursday night at 8 p.m. at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. And good evening.
Thank you so much, David. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Rhea.